Welcome to the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. In 2006, after publishing his biography of Joseph Smith, historian Richard Bushman reflected on the experience of writing about the Mormon prophet. In his journal, he wrote, "The whole episode is fading, like the dead gradually forgetting the living in Thornton Wilder's play Our Town. Unfortunately, this book, like other books I've written, will pursue me for years." This two-part episode of the FAIR Podcast is another vindication of that suspicion. We'll talk with Bushman about his research on Joseph Smith, in addition to other general Mormon studies issues. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Thanks for joining us today, Richard.
Pleasure.
About your work on Joseph Smith, you said that you hadn't yet sorted out the experience. It's been a couple of years now. Have you gained any more perspective on how the book's been received?
I don't think I have more facts now than I did then, but the most significant perspective I've come to is the sense that the book was not just a book, it was a phenomenon. And by that I mean, you know, I did my best to make it interesting, but I think the reception of it, which was far more welcoming than I ever anticipated, reflected sort of a state of Mormon culture. That there were a lot of people who were ready for kind of a down-to-earth, common sense kind of portrayal of the prophet that rooted him in this world, a person they could know. And I think that was a matter of maturation of the whole culture. Not everyone has come to the same point of view, of course, and there are a lot of people who are very critical of the book, but I think there were many more than I suspected who were ready for just that kind of a picture.
And you talked about criticism of the book. One of the things that you pointed out in your journal was that some people felt that you were too sympathetic, that you didn't get enough digs in at Joseph Smith, and there were other Mormons who were upset about some of your candor. So first, can you talk a little bit about some of the criticisms? Were there some specific things that people thought you didn't do a good job covering in Joseph Smith's life?
Well, there was one omission which I regret myself. And that is his marriage to Helen Mar Kimball. I didn't feel like I could cover every last wife that he married, even though the stories are all interesting. And so I just passed her by, forgetting that 14-year-old marriage was has really become a red flag and troubles a lot of people, and I should have dealt with it. So that was a criticism that I think was well deserved.
How would you deal with that now? Give us a little background about Helen Mar and Joseph Smith.
Well, she's a young girl, 14 years old, not particularly interested in marrying anyone at that stage. But Joseph, who had attempted or offered to form a marital bond with the Kimball family by marrying the late Kimball, and then pulled back that offer when it proved to be too heartbreaking.
This is the wife of Heber C. Kimball.
And it's their daughter. So after that bonding between Joseph and the Kimball clan failed, that is the marriage to Valate, then Heber Kimball comes to Joseph and says, "Will you consider marrying my daughter?" And he agrees as a matter of, as Todd Compton calls it, dynastic connection. So I think the error is to see this as a powerful slanderer using his cultural and social position to intimidate and take a girl. I just don't think you can read it that way. You may have many objections to it, but it really had another motive, which was this linking of families, which is so absolutely important to Joseph Smith.
So you see that ceiling less in terms of Joseph Smith gratifying lust, more in terms of him forging bonds. Is that?
I mean, Todd Compton came to that conclusion long ago, and I do too. You know, I've been making the case for quite some time now that Joseph's polygamy is quite different from Brigham Young's. Brigham Young's polygamy is domestic polygamy. He sets up households. He takes responsibility for women. He acknowledges them as his wives. He raises children by them. Joseph does none of those things. He has, so far, we can't prove he had a single child by any of those women. He doesn't take care of them. His whole purpose was to connect. There was that sealing connection. So I call his polygamy sealing. And it seems a little strange and a little incomprehensible to us today, but there's no doubt it was of immense importance to Joseph Smith.
Some people would feel more comfortable if they think that Joseph never had sexual relations with plural wives, but do you think the evidence points in another direction?
Well, I think he did have sexual relations. I think there was no barrier to having sexual relations once he's married to them. And we have direct testimony from a number of women that there were marital connections of that kind. But for the great share, the great bulk of these women, there is no evidence one way or another. And the fact that there are just, we can't prove any children, to me is some indication that if there was sexual relations, it was not regular, it wasn't constant, there wasn't a sort of a harem operation going on here at all. He had something else in mind.
And this aspect of Joseph Smith's life is sort of off the radar for a lot of practicing Mormons today. And when it comes up, it feels kind of foreign to Mormon religion today. How do you situate it in Mormon thought?
It's a heartbreaker. We think it's a bad PR problem for us that polygamy still hangs around our neck, even though it's over a century past. But the real heartbreak is for many a Mormon woman who just feels that having that in the past and potentially in the future casts a shadow over their relationships with their husbands now. So it's not a small problem at all. I think it's important to point out the sealing aspect of it. That's one avenue. I think the other point that I'm now contemplating, I'm not sure I can nail this down, is that clearly this was a practice not forever, not as an eternal law, but for a time. That's what the Book of Mormon says. It's clearly for a time. And I think it was to build up Israel. I think that was the point of it.
Plural marriage does tend to bother a lot of Latter-day Saints today. I think when we think about it, it just seems so different from what we've experienced. After you wrote the biography, you received a number of letters from people who asked you about that. And what's some of the advice you'd give to someone who wrote you and said, you know, I don't understand what Joseph Smith was doing, and it's bothersome to me.
You mean about polygamy or about everything?
Polygamy or any other issue that perhaps they weren't aware of before reading the book.
Yeah. Well, my policy has been as a scholar to never evade problems. I think it's a mistake to think we can circumvent them or bury them under the rug or hide them. That simply does not work. I think you have to confront them directly. And I think that's works for scholars. I think it works for individuals. If there's something that really annoys you in Joseph Smith's life, you should state as clearly and exactly as possible what it is that's troubling, even writing it down. Because in the very process of understanding the problem, you often go halfway towards finding a resolution or a perspective that's helpful to you. So I think people who are having troubles with the church develop this vague sense of doom, of something horrible happening. And so long as you're just fighting demons, you can't get anywhere. You've got to bring them out in the open and say exactly what it is that's the problem.
One issue that people bring up is Joseph Smith's first vision. There were different accounts that Joseph Smith gave of that. The earliest account from 1832. What sticks out to you about that earliest written account?
I read those varying accounts somewhat differently than some. Many Mormons are struck by the first one seeming to indicate a single visitor, the Lord, versus the Father and the Son later on. That doesn't strike me as a heavy-duty problem, because when we tell stories, and this is a very abbreviated account, some things get left in that are brought out later. What strikes me is most important about the 1832 account is that it's not about all the churches being wrong. That's one subordinate question. The primary question is, what is his standing with the Lord? And the primary outcome of this vision was that he was forgiven. So in a sense, it's a conversion experience. I always say that the first act of the restoration has to be getting the soul of the prophet in order. And forgiveness plays a large part at this point in Joseph Smith's life.
It seemed that forgiveness was foremost in his mind when he went to the grove. That reminds me of 3 years later when he's praying again, and Moroni comes to him. It seems to me the same kind of question then.
The same question. How does he stand with the Lord? And that question never went away. When Joseph Smith receives a visit from Christ in the Kirtland Temple, one of the first things Christ says to him is, "Your sins are forgiven you." We sort of lose sight of the personal religious needs of Joseph Smith because he's such a man of action and force and strength. But he was a man who had sorrows for his own sins and needed forgiveness.
In the past, we've emphasized the Joseph Smith story as him going into the grove, wondering which church was true, asking, receiving an answer. And you're saying a different way to look at it would be a personal example of someone seeking personal forgiveness in a relationship with God.
I think that's more consonant with his time in life, but also with his culture, where that is the question. That is, how do you stand with God? I'm not saying he wasn't concerned about the churches, because I think that's a family problem. Where do we go for religious guidance? So that's certainly in his mind. But what he needed a church for was to find salvation, and that's what he's seeking for above all.
You've pointed out the visionary culture that Joseph Smith grew up in, and as Latter-day Saints, we often see his experience in the Sacred Grove as something quite singular, and you see a more cultural bent to it. Can you talk about the visionary culture that surrounded Joseph Smith when he had his first vision?
One of the best historians of early Methodism say that Methodism in the United States, up until the first decades of the 19th century, was really a culture of visions and spiritual experiences. And there are scores of accounts of people having visions. A common one being the heavenly journey, where you leave this life and go into heaven and you see members of your family and neighbors who have died, and then often you'll see Christ, and then he will give you a commission. It's not exactly first vision, which has its own unique qualities, but the idea of having visions, seeing into heaven, and seeing divinity, that is not uncommon at all.
So if it wasn't uncommon, he talks about the reactions that he got from some people. I think he mentions a Methodist minister who tells him, you know, that's off base. Where was that minister coming from?
Well, where I read that is in the evolution of Methodist culture. The Methodists were very emotional and passionate in their early years, but as they evolved as a church, they became much more respectable. There's some wealthy people. It becomes very much a middle-class church. And there comes a point where the Methodists of the 1830s repudiate the Methodists of the 1800s. And Joseph Smith is right at that hinge where Methodism is trying to poo-poo. And the reason that Methodist minister had a quick answer to Joseph Smith is he faced these questions all the time inside his own church. And he's trying to discourage that kind of outburst.
Do you think Joseph recognized that, or do you think he was young enough to where he didn't realize where he stood?
He had no idea where he stood. He's not very much aware of church cultures of any kind at that stage in his life.
Now, having written a biography of Joseph, you kind of entered this club of people who've tried to put their arms around his life and put it out in a book. You've talked about your experience as a young man reading Fawn Brodie's biography of Joseph Smith. Can you talk about what that was like when you were younger? You're reading Fawn Brodie and you're a Mormon.
I can't remember exactly when it was. The book was published in 1945. I was in New England for college, And she was living in Connecticut, I believe, when she was excommunicated. And S. Dilworth Young, who was mission president when I first arrived in New England, I believe had been involved in that. I may be a little wrong on that, but he was telling stories of it. So I was sort of aware of her as a person in the environment. I read the book. It was not an earthquake for me. I don't know whether it's because I was at Harvard and I was sort of accustomed to sort of critical attitudes towards religion, and this was just one more. I sensed it not as a challenge to my testimony, but as kind of an intellectual challenge. That is, there are a host of pesky questions that she raised that I felt we would have to deal with them. So I went through the book and marked it all up, all the points where I thought there were problems. And I suppose it's true that even as I wrote 50 years later, I was in a way responding to Von Brody. Not toe-to-toe, not point-by-point, but sort of an attitude towards Joseph Smith.
Who was Von Brody's Joseph Smith? What was he like?
Von Brody's Joseph Smith was actually a great improvement from a Mormon point of view on earlier Joseph Smiths. Up until her time, Joseph Smith had been a scoundrel, probably mentally unbalanced, coming from a defective line of ne'er-do-wells and half-crazy people. And he was just an unbelievable sort of fiction of writers, even the most serious writers, the scholars and so on. Von Brody, though she had no concern about pleasing Mormons, still turned him into a human being. And he was a human being who had these sort of this quality of being able to spin yarns. Once his imagination got going, he could just turn out anything. So the Book of Mormon is just sort of this fictional creation of this marvelous teller of tales, but sort of had a way of pretending to be pious. She never took his religion very seriously. She thought it was sort of skin deep. He was more actor than minister. But it was a kind of a believable portrait. I've had colleagues, historical colleagues, who thought it was a very positive biography because compared to what had preceded it, it was positive. It was a believable human being.
It seemed to take him more seriously.
It took him more seriously, though it never quite took his religion seriously. She's writing in the post-30s. It's an era of skepticism. It's sort of a Mencken, H.L. Mencken time of making fun of the bourgeoisie, and here's an extreme example of a nutty religion.
And so the Joseph Smith that's kind of a pious fraud, what in the historical record took you to see Joseph Smith differently?
Well, frankly, I don't think you can read the Book of Mormon, 584 pages of intense, constant, unrelenting ministerial preaching filled with piety and devotion and absolutely unyielding in its sense of God's presence in the world. I mean, he made it all up, how could he do that unless there were very deep wells of sincere piety in his heart and mind? And she was just tone deaf to all those things. She just could not pick it up and take it seriously. But the evidence is just all over the place.
Speaking of evidence, one of the barriers I think that people in the past have had is getting to the historical record, and obviously that's changing a little bit here with the project that you're working on with the Church Historical Department, the Joseph Smith Papers Project. For people who haven't heard much about it, can you give a brief description of what the Joseph Smith Papers Project is trying to do?
The project is extraordinarily ambitious. It's attempting to collect not only the things that Joseph Smith wrote, but all the journals that were kept for him, all the official documents of the church, even elements of minutes of meetings where he was presiding and shaping the decisions. So it goes far beyond the definition of papers for Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and will probably end up with at least 20 volumes of his journals, of the histories that he wrote or sponsored, even that he told John Whitman wrote a history, that will be there. The documents, including all the letters and proclamations, so on, all the revelations, legal papers he was in, cases he was involved in, and then many of these administrative records, these minutes of meetings. So it's a huge project, and rests on the assumption established by the president of the church, President Hinckley, that it is primarily for scholars. It must be absolutely accurate. It must be completely open. Nothing must be hidden. All issues are to be dealt with. So it's really an example of the new Mormon history at its best, where apologetics is not the point. It's just open disclosure of what the facts are.
And you mentioned apologetics. Some people outside the church have looked at your biography and some of your work and said, you're an apologist for Joseph Smith. Where do you situate yourself in the subject, in the topic of apologetics when you talk about your own work?
Well, there's no question that I have great affection and love and admiration for Joseph Smith, and I hope that comes through in the book. I personally think that biographies written out of love are always better than those that are written out of a more jaundiced point of view.
I don't tell that to Hitler's biography.
No, there are some exceptions, it's true. But, you know, John D. Rockefeller, you can rake him up and down the coals, but Chernoff's biography of him is written with great affection and admiration. All the great biographies are affectionate biographies. So there's that. I haven't felt any obligation to explain things that are difficult to explain, like polygamy. I don't try to say, well, it all makes sense if you just look at it the right way. It doesn't necessarily make sense. It just happened. So when I run into things like that, I just tell what happened. And in the end, personally, I think that's more persuasive and attractive than a book that tries to tidy everything up and make it all seem correct and right.
When we were speaking of Fawn Brody, that's kind of where you two meet. Is she didn't seem as concerned, as you said, to keep Mormons alongside her. And you've talked about your desire to keep Mormons along with you in rough stone rolling in the biography, but also to give outsiders a glimpse at what it's like to see Joseph Smith from the inside. And it seemed like, from some of your writings, that you felt, even though you tried that, maybe that it couldn't fully work with some people.
Yeah.
What was the difficulty there?
Well, it's a gap that I'm not sure can ever be closed completely, because our assumptions about the formative experiences of Joseph Smith are so different going from a believer to a non-believer. So I'm kind of reconciled that there will always be a gap there. I do believe that Mormons would do well to offer a Joseph Smith to the world at large that does not require them to believe. That is, we need to talk about a Joseph Smith that they can say, yes, I understand him now, without having to say God was with him, putting words in his mouth. And I tried to get as close as I could to that, but you know, there are points where it's quite obvious I'm in awe of what Joseph Smith did, and people can't go with me.
Is that what they're saying when they call you an apologist? When an outsider says that, what's the point of that?
Well, for instance, I talked to a guy, a very distinguished historian of New York City. And he asked me what I was doing. I said I was working on Joseph Smith. Little smirk on his face. And he said, well, Joseph Smith must have been nimble, meaning he had to hop around to keep all of these pretenses in order. And when I So there's a preconception. There's a preconception that when he founded the Kirtland Bank, he was really trying to hoodwink the people. He was another speculator who was trying to pull a fast one. And when I don't go along with that, I don't present this character who's nimble and a little bit scandalous in his activities, then they think somehow I haven't captured the real Joseph Smith. I would insist I have stuck with the sources. I haven't gone beyond the sources, and my challenge to them is: you find me evidence that he was nimble or that he was pulling a fast one.
The story, what they bring up is that story of the gold. They have they had boxes at the Kirtland Bank that they would put stones in or something and then cover them with one layer of money or something. What's the story with the Kirtland Bank in that situation?
Well, I don't think I have anything to say about that that particular story. I do believe that Joseph Smith acted like all of the bankers in the last 2 years. Banks are tricky because of the run phenomenon. You have to maintain confidence or the whole thing will unravel, even if you're a perfectly sound institution. So there's a lot of talk of encouragement, hold on, brethren, we're going to make it. You never know how much to trust these stories about pretense. I wouldn't be surprised if there were shenanigans to try to say, look at all this money, or everything's okay, which we wouldn't hold up today, but would be understandable, even for someone who's quite sincere and really wanted the well-being of the community above all else.
You've talked about some of the reactions from members of the church who kind of maybe approach you and wonder where you stand after they've read your book. What kind of reactions have you gotten from just average members of the church who bump into you?
Well, Claudia and I met someone on one of our trips who wanted to know, wasn't sure she wanted to read the book until she knew the author. And when she learned that I'd been a bishop and I was a patriarch, she says, all right, now I will read the book because I will trust you. And so I had other friends who said, when members of my ward would say, what do you think of that terrible book? And then they just said, well, he's a patriarch. And then that settled the whole question.
This is kind of a funny quote from your journal here. I realize a new biography of Joseph Smith does not register with many saints. They know his life. Why read 500 pages to learn what they already know? So why read 500 pages?
Well, what surprised me was the number of people who said, I read your book, I read it in 2 weeks, and I'm now reading it for the third time, or something like that. I think it was quite startling to Latter-day Saints to find so many things they didn't know when they thought they were masters of Joseph Smith's life.
What does it mean to write a balanced biography of a person? What is a balanced biography?
Well, we all know that's an impossible question. What's one man's balance is another man's bias. I think, in effect, what it meant was, instead of combing through the records for examples of Joseph Smith saying extravagant things or covering up polygamy, I wanted to look at all those points where his big-hearted generosity or his love of cosmological exploration or his deep piety and bring those into the record. So I can't say that mine is more balanced than others, but mine, if you look at all the biographies together, mine brings in something that's been left out before.
There's a lot of judgment that has to be made by a historian when they're writing about Joseph Smith, I believe, based on the kind of sources that we have. And you've been knee-deep in them with the Joseph Smith Papers Project. You mentioned the history of the church. It's written, those six volumes are written in the first person, as though it were Joseph Smith writing them. And that doesn't really capture what the sources were.
At this point, I don't think any reputable scholars will cite the history of the church, the six-volume history. It is so flawed that it just is not to be trusted. Not that it is wrong, but it doesn't present itself for what it truly is. What it is a concoction by historians long after Joseph Smith's death, pulling together documents, excerpts from other people's journals, everything they could find that bore on his life at a given point, mushing it all together and putting it in the first person as if Joseph Smith was saying it. So the account of Zion's Camp, for example, is filled with stories that come out of many other people's biographies that were thrown into the story 5 or 10 years after he's left the scene, and gives you a Joseph Smith that really is somebody else's Joseph Smith. It's not what he said of himself.
So what were they trying to do then? Some of the early church historians, George A. Smith, who was a cousin of the prophet, was one of them, Willard Richards. What did they see themselves as doing? They were putting it in first person. Did they see a problem with that, or what was their approach historically?
It was very common. This is not shenanigans of any kind. It's pseudepigraphic literature. You know, all of these writings in the 2nd century B.C. and C.E. in the name of Abraham or of Enoch that give it authenticity and interest. This was a way of sort of telling a narrative. You could say every historian is lying because they pull together little pieces from all over and tell it as if it were one clean story when it's really just their minds making up something based on the little stuff they have. So the fact that you put it in Joseph Smith's own voice is a very small departure from what we do all the time anyway.
With the Joseph Smith Papers Project, what are some of the things that have really excited you seeing come out of that project, or perhaps things that you wished you had when you were writing Rough Stone Rolling?
Yeah. The greatest additions to the corpus of Joseph Smith materials has come in the legal area. The legal historians who've been working on it have discovered thousands of documents related to cases he was involved in. There are probably upward around 200 different cases. Almost every point of his life, he was involved in a suit in court. And that has yet to be taken into account. Elsewhere, there isn't a lot of new additional material. There are certain areas, this Revelations Book 1, as it's called, which was the printer's copy for the Book of Commandments, has some new revelations here or there. I would say none of them have been startling. They have enriched the story by adding details. What is, I think the contribution will be, is to make them convenient, for one thing, well indexed, and then annotated so that you can read along and you find out a name comes up, you know, immediately where that person is. You get references to other diaries where some similar matters are dealt with, and the whole what comes out of it is not a new view of the past, but an enrichment of the story we've pretty much known.
With all those legal issues that you mentioned, was that unusual for a public figure in the 1800s? Was it unusual to be involved in so many lawsuits? Or?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if you compared it to Andrew Jackson or the governor of Missouri, whoever. I doubt that there'd be as many. However, a large number of these were debt suits, and that is commonplace. This is a society that runs on credit because you don't have an established currency or established banking system that is very stable. So people are always borrowing from one another. And that inevitably led to lawsuits, and Joseph Smith was part of that. He was one of the leaders of the debt culture in those days.
And the sources we've talked about, the history of the church being written in the first person, even though Joseph didn't write it, where can people go to perhaps get closer to Joseph himself as far as sources are concerned?
I think the single most valuable book on Joseph Smith is Dean Jesse's collection of essays, The Personal Writings of Joseph Smith. Partly because a small number of them, said in boldface type, are his own words. That is, he wrote them or they were directly dictated. But it's also useful because he moves from the prophetic and the presidential to the personal. He writes to his close friends, and especially his letters to Emma, I think, are revealing. So we have to use those letters, and especially things like the 1832 history of his first vision and so on, which is virtually all in his hand, to really get a flavor. We don't know who wrote the first vision story of 1838. Apparently the whole first presidency was involved. So it's really an institutional account of the beginning of the church. The 1832 story is Joseph's. And I think that's the best way to really get at him.
Dean Jesse's collection of those personal writings came out, if I remember correctly, it came out around a little bit after the Mark Hoffman affair, with forgeries being made in Joseph Smith's hand. Do you think that instances like that, do you think that helped the church want to get more of the record published? Do you think that served as a way for Dean to say, we need to get these records in a book that people can access? What brought that about?
It's a very good question, and I would like to know the answer. I had not thought of Mark Hoffman playing a role, but he may have. That having faced so many phony documents, all of a sudden, the church said, look, we've got to get down to what's real.
What's helped bring the Joseph Smith Papers Project?
Yeah.
What kind of got the ball rolling for that?
Yeah. The church went through some kind of sea change in the late 90s or the early years of this century, because you got Mountain Meadows being commissioned and written in this same period. And somehow or other, it became clear that the only way to deal with difficult matters was just to tell the story as factually and accurately as possible, not to spin it, not to hide it, but to tell it. So for years before that time, Dean had been working on the Smith Papers, got out two volumes. We had a third volume that he had done his part on, but was hung up on the question of references to the temple ceremony. This was the 1843-44 period, and to Joseph's arguments with his wife during the polygamy period. And the church was anguished. They didn't know quite how to deal with this. And Ron Espin and I went up and talked endlessly. We made presentation after presentation trying to break this logjam. Let us publish this volume. Let it go on. And always we seemed so close, but couldn't quite get it right. And then suddenly, within a two-year period, Dean himself began to think more broadly of how this could actually be done. And the church bought it. It just, Larry Miller turned up the scene with the money to pay for it. Within, you know, just sort of a three-year period, it just suddenly blossomed. And Hoffman, I think that's a very good thought. But I don't know what else. I think sometime when the intellectual history of the church is written, that moment is going to have to be explored, because it was a great change point.
One thing with the Joseph Smith Papers Project that people have asked about are the minutes for the Council of 50. Has there been any discussion about those minutes for those meetings being part of the project?
Yeah. The Smith Papers editorial staff, of course, wants everything out. They don't want to publish the papers and then 10 years later says, well, we had something in our own possession which didn't get into the papers. No one knows exactly what stands in the way. There's never been an explanation what would be troublesome about it. There is sometimes just habits that linger.
Yeah, who read them? Has anyone even...
I know of no one who's read them. And at this point, you know, we're just so prepared to deal with anything under the sun. What might have been shocking 25 years ago, I doubt would be shocking today. And if we can deal with Mountain Meadows, we ought to be able to deal with about anything.
As you did the biography for Joseph Smith, I'm sure that you confronted the issue of your beliefs versus the believing mind of Richard Bushman and the academic mind of Richard Bushman. And how did those two come together as you went through the sources and hammered out a narrative for Joseph Smith?
You know, I've been asked that question many times, but I've never felt like it describes the reality of my life. You know, when I started writing this, I really started in 1997 and wrote pretty steadily on it for the next 7 years. By that time, I was in my 60s, and ever since I'd been an undergraduate, I had lived in environments where I was surrounded by skeptics, by historians, by scholars, and if not in person, I'd had to debate in my own mind, what would I say to these people if I were asked a question about this or that? So that those two minds had really more and more overlapped and merged. So that I just sort of had one way of approaching things, which was, what is there? What can be said? And so it wasn't a strain, you know, parsing fine differences to make sure I was in balance. I think part of it comes from living in the outskirts of the church, so I was not aware of it. You know, one way of speaking that comes from Salt Lake and then another way of speaking that comes from New York City. I just had one way of speaking. I was a New Yorker, and that's how I told the story.
In the journal On the Road with Joseph Smith, you talked about while you were waiting to give some patriarchal blessings, and you were thinking through a paper that you're going to present to a historical society. So that's not your typical church patriarch. So kind of along that same line of the previous question, then here's a patriarch and a historian sitting. Can you tell me what it's... I just want to hear you talk a little bit more about that. You're a patriarch, you're a historian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's put it this way. It may be also that I'm a realist in this sense. I don't think people have to be perfection to be prophets or to be holy and exalted in order to speak for the Lord. So that I've never been illusioned at all about the necessity of Joseph Smith living without error in his life, or maybe making even large errors. And so for the people around me, I was a bishop. I know what it's like to be a bishop. I was just as human as a bishop as I was without. So I've never expected too much. On the other hand, I love the idea that flawed people can still act and speak for God. That those bishops work miracles. And they blunder, they make mistakes, they step on people's toes. On the other hand, they still do marvelous things, acts of generosity and insight and wisdom. So it's that combination of God speaking through frail human beings that I find inspiring. So that's why I say I think I'm a realist, that good and bad get all intermingled.
I've heard you talk about a similar thing and as seeing that as a legacy of Joseph Smith, something that he sought to institutionalize. Talk a little bit about how Joseph Smith and leadership and hierarchy come together and how that even resonates through the church mm-hmm. today.
Well, it's, I think, distinctive Joseph Smith. I may be a little wrong on that. But this idea of a man whose authority among his comrades depends on his great gifts. he has these charismatic powers. He can speak for the Lord. He sees Christ and so on. Still wanting to share those powers. He wants Oliver Cowdery to go down and pray about baptism, and then they have a revelation together. And he does that with Sidney Rigdon, and he goes beyond that to say, I want all of you to see God. He really has this very democratic sense of the availability of divine manifestations to quite ordinary people. And you start with that in sort of his personal style of prophethood, and go on to how the church is built on that, and said every last one of you is to have the Spirit of God as you're doing your home teaching, as you're running the ward, as you're putting together a Relief Society dinner. Everything is to be done with charisma. You are to speak for God. So I think that creates a remarkable organization of what I call God speakers. We're all meant to speak for God to one another. Testimony meeting, sacrament meeting, Sunday school. We're told we are to teach as we're moved upon by the Spirit.
Do you think Joseph Smith sensed the other side of that, with the kind of a danger to the democratization of charisma that way?
I think he did. He experienced it. I think it's close to a miracle that it didn't result in utter chaos. And, of course, it's that early moment where he asserts his authority to speak for the church and then insists on that through to the end.
Is that the Hiram Page?
The Hiram Page incident.
What happened there?
Well, that's the incident where someone else has a seer stone and is receiving revelation, and Joseph Smith, very worried about this, receives a revelation which said he is the one who writes for God. Oliver Cowdery, the others could speak as they wished by inspiration, but he would be the writer for God. And in a way, he has the last word. It's like the Constitution says it is the supreme law of the land. Then under the Constitution, lots of things can go on, but it maintains that solid core. If that hadn't have been done, Mormonism would have collapsed. It would have flown apart into pieces.
You mentioned the seer stone, and that's something that's also kind of unusual to church members today. I tended to have a mental picture of him translating with the gold plate sitting on the table, the scribe sitting across from him, and him concentrating and studying it out in his mind. And then we have these accounts where he's putting his face in a hat.
Yeah.
And doing. Can you talk about the translation process?
Well, I'll begin by saying that we still have pictures on our board bulletin boards of Joseph Smith with gold plates in front of him. And that's become an irksome point, and I think something the church should pay attention to. Because anyone who studies the history knows that is not what happened. There is no church historian who says that is what happened. And yet it's being propagated by the church. And it feeds into the notion that the church is trying to cover up embarrassing episodes and is sort of prettifying its own history. So I think we ought to just stop that immediately. I'm not sure we need a lot of pictures in our chapels of Joseph Smith looking into his hat, but we certainly should tell our children that's how it worked.
Do you think that's really unusual? I mean, that's a strange...
It's weird. It's a weird picture. It implies it's like darkening a room when we show slides. It implies that there is an image appearing in that stone, and the light would make it more difficult to see that image. So that implies a translation that's it's a reading. And so it gives us a little clue about the whole translation process. But it also raises the strange question, what in the world are the plates for? Why do we need them on the table if they're just wrapped up in a cloth while he looks into a seer stone?
Another question about that, the seer stone. In the biography, you talk about the kind of the treasure-seeking culture that Joseph Smith grew up in. And Joseph wasn't the only one that said he had a seer stone as a young man. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. Of course.
What was going on?
Well, he got his seer stone from someone who sister was a seer stone, and there was sort of looker, And there's sort of this little tussle about who owns that seer stone, who has a right to it. This is Willard Chase and Sally Chase. So it's very much in the era. It's sort of like an aquifer under the top level of culture. There is this underground level of magic and marvels that descends from the 17th century, when it wasn't an aquifer, it was a river on the top of the stream, and you have all sorts of people involved in magic, people of distinction, noted intellectuals, members of parliament would have seer stones. But it goes underground, and Joseph Smith is still dipping into that. So it's all around him in his neighborhood. Lots of people were seeking for treasure, just like his father was.
So there are people who would say, see, Joseph was just one of those seer stone guys, and then he decided to make church of it.
Yeah.
Where's that transition for him, though?
Well, I don't think that's a totally inaccurate description. He was one of those seer stone guys. And you can see that as just kind of a charlatan who practiced fakery as a magician and treasure seeker, who becomes a charlatan who sells snake oil religion. So you can tell the story that way. I've attempted to tell that story another way, in that Joseph was going to be asked to do things that were quite unorthodox by standard Christian standards, which was to translate a book. And he had to be prepared so he had confidence this was something right and functional. And the seer stone culture, which we think of as superstitious and to be looked down upon, he took seriously, and that prepared him to translate those plates.
As you were touring, promoting the book about stone rolling, the gold plates continually came up. And in one of your journal entries, you said, I intend to confront the gold plates problem head on, the foundation for thinking of Joseph Smith as a fraud. This is back in 2005 that you wrote that, and you've said that your new project that you're working on now deals with the gold plates. Were the seeds that early when you were doing the Joseph biography, and it's grown into the next project?
Well, there it is in the book. The seed must have been there, though I certainly wasn't thinking of writing a book about the gold plates as I am now. That idea is just about a year old at most. But Dan Vogel says it's Joseph's claimed gold plates that is the final evidence that he was a fraud. He might have been a pious fraud, but he was a fraud, because you could be sincere and say, I saw God in the vision. That's happened all through history. But if you say, I have a diamond in my drawer, in my bedroom, that's fraud. You're trying to pull a fast one. And so the gold plates sort of have that function.
So what do you want to do in this? You're doing a full book. Is there a contract yet, or are you?
I'm far away from a contract. It's a strange kind of book. I'm sort of thinking of this like a Wikipedia book, where it becomes kind of, in a way, a communal project. I find it a fascinating topic. It leads in many directions where I have no expertise at all, and I think it would be kind of fun to get a lot of people making a contribution from their perspective about the gold plates. So at this point, as I usually do, I don't go for contracts and for books. I'm just sort of letting the idea develop, with the confidence that energetic ideas attract energy. And I made this little presentation this summer to Terrell's summer seminar and to some of the Institute people, and they now want to have a symposium on the gold plates and to run a couple of summer seminars on the gold plates. So it's an idea that I think has some resonance at this point.
What kind of questions are going to be can be asked about the gold plates that could fill a book or fill a seminar?
Well, that was my reaction, everybody's reaction. You know, Joseph has them for 21 months. I mean, what more is there to say? But they refuse to die. They as soon as the word gets out that there is this book of gold, that immediately captures people's attention. The very first newspaper article on Mormonism speaks of the Gold Bible. E.D. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled has on its title page the Gold Bible in bold type, and it continues to fascinate people down to the present. Consider all our pictures of Joseph Smith with gold plates, or the many replicas of gold plates. And every biennial church art exhibit has entries that show the gold plates and the Sword of Laban. So there's force that emanates from those plates, and it leads in lots of directions. It leads into research directions, very high-end efforts to determine, did ancient Israelites write on metal? Huge amount of effort gone into trying to collect that information. So what I want to do is not to do the research Farms would do, but to tell the story of Farms doing it. That is, I'm interested in what the gold plates does to Mormon culture. It produces kitsch. It produces high-end scholarship. It produces all sorts of speculation. And I see that as all part of the cultural history of the gold plates.
You talked about Joseph Smith transitioning from a seer stone guy to a prophet. Do you think the stone played a role in facilitating that move? Do you think that it trained him to be ready for more revelations? Or where do you see Joseph Smith coming from a youth with the seer stone to a prophet who has now put that stone away and receives direct revelation?
I don't think Joseph Smith ever thought that the seer stone was something to be ashamed of. Maybe he played it down as he became a little more cosmopolitan and realized how that sounded. But he never gave up on the seer stone. I think it is possible he carried the seer stone with him through his life. And I think people around him believe that that was a more sure mode of communication than just having thoughts come into your mind. So the seer stone did not have to disappear. What had to disappear was the seer stone as a way of making money, that it was part of an economy of finding gold and treasure. And that is the issue for Joseph Sr. As he says in the 1826 trial, there were higher purposes for these things, this gift that Joseph had, than just making money. It was true for Oliver Cowdery, who really was felt the power of getting his hands on all that gold, and attributes that to Joseph Smith's thinking too. So he had to put that aside, and he had to realize that some of his seer stone companions were not going to be with him forever. Josiah Stoll stuck with him, made the transition. His father and his brothers did too. But the Chases and the Spaffords and some of the others in the neighborhood didn't. So he had to extricate himself from some of the values of that seer stone culture and the social circle of the seer stone culture. But he didn't have to give up the seer stone in the idea that you could communicate through that technology.
Do people ever ask you if you believe Joseph literally saw something in the seer stone? Have you been asked that?
I've been asked that, but I don't see that as anything more than sort of an empirical question. Royal Skousen's making his case. It's always kind of persuasive. It always seems a little bit attenuated. He makes an awful lot turn on a few little marks on the page, but there's nothing on principle that seems to me offensive about that. We just don't know the technology of revelation, but I'm quite willing to say seer stones can help you see things.
And this is the last question. What are some of the future avenues for Joseph Smith in perhaps in academic research? What are some of the future avenues for researchers or for people who are interested in learning more about Joseph Smith?
I don't think the most profitable lines of research will be to go deeper into the sources looking for some undiscovered gem hiding under a rock somewhere. I think what is going to be illuminating is moving outward to put all of this activity in larger and larger frameworks, so that even though people object to John Brooks trying to put Joseph Smith into a context of Hermeticism, I think it's the right strategy. It's sort of seeing what he was doing in a much larger context. So the gold plates investigation will also have to look at all the recovery of lost records in world history, in the sense of finding voices that will speak out of the dust that will come to us. So, and that requires sort of cross-cultural research, and that's where I think we need to go.
This is the end of part one of our interview with Richard Bushman. In part two, we'll talk with him about his new book from Oxford University Press, Mormonism, A Very Short Introduction. We'll talk with him about other issues in Mormon studies, including the negotiation between reason and faith. Questions or comments about this episode can be emailed to podcast@fairlds.org or submit a comment on the blog at fairblog.org.